Hey, Jenna.
Uh-huh.
I've got an interesting question for you.
Okay.
What do marketers and magicians have in common?
Oh, they're always slashing things in half.
Price cut. No, I mean, while that is absolutely right, it's actually a lot more than you'd think.
This is Digital Marketer. This week, Brian Brushwood.
Hello and welcome to the Digital Marketer Podcast. I'm Jenna.
And I'm Garrett.
And today we're going to be talking about how to build an audience, not just an audience, but a loyal audience that will do anything for you.
And today we're going to be learning about all of this from our guest, Brian Brushwood. Not only is Brian a phenomenal magician, but he holds a number one spot for an album on the Billboard charts. He's a best-selling author. He's got millions of subscribers on all of his social media channels. And he also has multiple television shows on Discovery Channel and National Geographic. Brian's got a lot going on. And as a marketer, you might be thinking, why do I want to listen to a magician talk to me about his story or his experience? Well, the interesting part about his story and this conversation that we had with him is just the way that he breaks down how to build an audience, how to build a loyal fan base, and how to get your name out there, your business out there in front of more and more people every single day. You know, his approach to building an audience is definitely something that can be applied to any business. And it really is fascinating to see the connection between magic and marketing.
And if you're sitting here and you're thinking, well, he has millions of subscribers, da doy. He also would frequently start from scratch onto a totally new platform and channel. And he kind of takes us through how he did that, how he scorched and burned so many different times and just used the same techniques to continually grow his fan base.
Yeah. I mean, everyone starts from nothing. And Brian was no exception to that rule. Brian kind of bootstrapped his way to building an audience. And he tells us all about that. Starting on stage and collecting email addresses from fans in different comedy venues. I mean, he really took the idea of digital marketing offline and then brought it back online once he started to build this audience. And it's really fascinating to kind of hear how he continually tries to find ways to stay alive in the mind of his audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, without further ado, Brian Brushwood.
Brian, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh my gosh. You. Look, you people, I don't understand how you do it. You do the incredible. You exist before 9 a.m.
yes,
the
we
day
do.
Star. It's a real thing. I thought
yes,
it was a myth.
Yes, we do. Yeah. So before we dive into all of the topics that we've got planned for today.
Sure.
Will you take us back to the beginning? Talk to us about where your love for magic began.
Man, the normal answer every magician gives is, I did a trick when I was 7 years old. I fell in love with magic. And yes, I did have a magic kit when I was like 7 years old. And I liked magic. But it wasn't until I was 18 and I was going to college. A friend of mine showed me a card trick, wouldn't tell me how it was done. And all of a sudden, I had a lot of free time at college because I didn't know anybody. Mm-hmm. I only had, 3 or 4 hours a day to go to classes. And I've decided out of spite that I was going to be a better magician than he ever was. So unlike every other magician who talks about their great love for magic, I was like, no. I was driven by hate. And after a few months, I picked up a few cool tricks. I was that guy at the party who knew magic. Somebody offered me $20 an hour to do walk around magic, which was
nice.
Just
that's pretty awesome.
The king's fortune, right?
Yeah.
And so I started doing magic on the side. But it wasn't until May of 99 that I was working a day job up at Dell. It was a great day job as far as day jobs go. But I realized I was really living for Wednesday nights when down just off of 6th Street, there's a band called the Asylum Street Spankers that would take their band break. And then I would go on for 15 minutes, eat fire, escape from a straitjacket and pass the hat. And there was something so artistically honest and pure about that, that I loved it. And then I got a raise at my day job. And I realized, oh, crap, this is how it happens. At some point, the money gets too good and you don't have the option to walk away. So while I was still good and poor, I told Bonnie, I was like, just give me 1 year. I can handle failing. I can't handle not knowing if I could have made it.
Yep.
You know, I didn't want to be that guy at the age I am now.
But,
you know, at 43, he was just like, yeah, I've played around with magic. I've kept up with it a little bit. But also, you know, quarterly meetings coming up. So Bonnie was nice enough. She said, I'll keep the lights on for 1 year. Show me what you got. And turns out I had very little.
Okay. You mentioned Dell. What was kind of your path before diving into this entrepreneurial journey of yours?
I was doing a liberal arts degree at the University of Texas. They have this program called the Plan 2 Honors Program, where the first 2 years, they tell you, take these maths, these sciences, these writing classes. Last 2 years, they say, take whatever you want, but know that you can't graduate unless you do a thesis. And for a thesis, people would write their first novel. They would do these 300-page biographies on
people. That's really cool.
And so I thought, like, well, maybe I could get a trick published or do a history on a magician or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went into the meeting with the dean, and they're like, okay, what do you want to do for your thesis? I got as far as saying the words, well, for the last couple of years, I've been doing magic on the side. And then she draws in this sharp breath. Like, and I was like, what did I do? And she goes, and you want to do a magic show as a creative writing thesis. What a great idea. I was like, you got to be kidding me, right?
Yeah.
So I ended up taking classes like a history of witchcraft, languages of science fiction, pseudoscience and the paranormal. And then out of that, though, I went into the tech field because I'd always loved doing tech stuff. I ran my own bulletin board system. I built my own computers. I was really into video games. But there was that moment where I sort of did this assessment of what I thought of as my natural gifts in that moment. I was like, I feel like I at least got to give a try to this magic thing. So as good as, you know, I love systems. If I am a good magician, if I am a good marketer, it all comes from whatever that drive is that makes me want to understand mechanical systems and electronic systems. In magic, you take advantage of what I think of as the flawed wetware of other human beings. The fact that we have these psychological backdoors that can be used for good by magicians or evil by con men. And I guess it's up to our audience to decide where marketing lays on that spectrum.
About to say good for magicians and evil for marketers.
Well, but think about that. Imagine the most good charity you could possibly imagine. They need to be using effective tools to get their message out to other people. So again, don't judge the tools, judge their use, I guess I would say.
Yeah.
So how did you market yourself in the early days?
In the early days, I had nothing, I was nothing, and I knew nothing.
Sounds like a great start.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah, probably still accurate.
Uh-huh.
But when you get started, here's what I knew, is I knew that my wife was working a 9-to-5 that she hated for me to be able to get started at all this. And I had a lot of imaginary discussions with everybody I respected in magic. Some of them actual discussions, like with Teller of Penn & Teller or Harry Anderson or so on. In this conversation, I picture, hey, have you ever had like a really bad gig that went really poorly? And in my mind, I couldn't imagine a single person I respected that would have the answer of, no, they're all pretty great. I'm great. No, like everybody's got disasters.
Yeah.
That's where we learn, is from the disasters. And so it occurred to me that also, if somebody was going to hire me for a corporate event, that type of person that they would want to hire would be the type of person with a very, very full calendar. So the first thing I did was figure out how many open mic nights I could book myself at and then list them on my calendar as appearances. So when you went to my webpage, you didn't know who Brian Brushwood is. You didn't know what was in his show, but by golly, he sure looks like a busy in-demand performer all the way down. Look, he's traveling. I would even do free events as far away as Houston, 3.5-hour drive, just because I would rather go do that and get the flight time than I would to have that empty date on my calendar because it was so important to, again, you know, fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
The trappings of authority, they matter. And so from there, I guess the overall advice is whenever possible, I sought to provide value to other people's platform so that I could have a little bit of their time and bandwidth. There's a talk radio station back 20 years ago, 98.9 KJFK, that actually, at the time that I showed up there, both Alex Jones and a guy, Shannon Burke, were doing shows at. So,
wow.
But it was clear, like, they wanted guests who could do interesting things.
Yeah.
And that was my show. You know, I'm hammering nails in my nose. I'm eating fire, sticking nails in my eyes or whatever.
Normal stuff.
So I kept showing up and they were all like, oh, would you mind performing? No, I don't mind performing because my voice is on the radio and I get to brag about how I was on the radio and all that stuff. So in the beginning, you know, I was providing value to them with entertainment and interesting stories, but also I was establishing my own platform by parasitically using yours. I guess that's kind of what's happening even now.
Totally. It's, you know, like, symbiotic.
Like I am providing content for you guys, but at the same time, I'm very happy to meet your audience and hopefully they'll dig my stuff.
Absolutely.
But so in the early days, you just got to keep showing up and advertise your platform by providing value on other people's platforms. This is also while I'm getting booked on the road. On the one hand, every time I booked a gig, I was like, this is great. I got money. I did it. I won. I harvested. It's over. But the show never really ends. So instead, I realized, oh, wait, a year from now, nobody will remember that this even happens. Nobody will remember my name. My goal was to stay alive in their minds. So every single show, I started doing a giveaway of, I wrote a little 30-page pitch book of magic tricks called 57 Ways to Scam a Free Drink. Cost me 50 cents to center staple 8 pages together. You know, I'd sell them for $5 really just as an excuse to sign something for people afterwards.
Yeah.
But during the show, I would mention that I was going to give away 5 of those to anybody who signed up on the email list. And so
amazing.
Gig after gig after gig for 15 years straight, my ritual was I would go home and I would take the inscrutable scrawling and try to punch in all the different emails. You know, yes, everybody thought they were very clever when they entered their name as Huge Ass. And then, but it was astonishingly tedious, but slowly, this dead bandwidth that all of my peers, you know, they would show up, they would do the show, they're done, they're out. Hey, but instead that chance to hold on to a thread of that, to remain alive in the mind of the other person, to hint like, hey, if you like that show, I'm doing a very, very slow, very long version of it that you can watch week after week as I send out these emails or whatever. I remember when we hit 30,000, I Googled trying to figure out all the things that we were, quote unquote, now bigger than. And so, you know, starting with like the population of Antarctica, you know, the city of Des Moines or whatever. Yeah. It's a very, very slow thing. And that was all before I had any kind of quote unquote official platform. That was before Scam School, before any of what I think of as my online career.
Yeah. So clearly it worked because now you've gone on to, and correct me if I'm wrong in any of these statistics, but you wrote 6 books, you've hosted a handful of podcasts, starred in TV shows and National Geographic and Discovery, created multiple successful YouTube channels, and created your own e-commerce store.
Yeah.
And more, obviously. But as an entrepreneur, how the hell do you balance your time and your sanity with all of these projects that have taken up your career?
Part of it is letting go of that which is outside your bandwidth, right? You can intend, you know, I genuinely intend to respond to every email that comes into my inbox. But at some point you recognize, oh, this is a river and you can't drink an entire river. What you could do is you could drink as much as you're able for as long as you can and then let other people know. You know, I tell people that if they want to get in touch with me, the best way is actually to @reply me on Twitter because there's no expectation that I will give you more than 280 characters in response. And that's a bite-sized thing that I can do, right?
Yeah.
But it's tough to jump from being a one-man show on the road to where I am now, partly because there are so many stories of all the people who have come into my life who have truly grokked a single part of the operation. I think I lucked into a group of, I guess there are 6 to 10 of us now. We're a small operation, but everybody carries the ball. Everybody knows where we're headed and we all agree and we get on the same page. And everybody has the opportunity to build their own sub empire over which they directly benefit from how stuff goes so that their incentives are aligned. I want them waking up every morning thinking like, how do we make this the biggest thing possible? What are the best practices?
So speaking of Twitter and making things big, you have over 2 million Twitter followers?
Just shy of 2 million. I'm going to talk all the numbers. Scam School is the biggest YouTube channel that we have. It's about 1.8 million subscribers. 2 years ago, we launched a new channel called The Modern Rogue, which is basically me and my buddy are on a quest to become the ultimate gentleman, warrior, and scoundrel. Imagine if Adam Savage from the Mythbusters didn't know how to build anything, but decided to try anyway. That's a lot of failures on that. After 2 years, that's now at just shy of 750,000. The third one is just a store account. It's literally just outtakes and new products called Scam Stuff. And then that one is up around 70,000. But Twitter is at 1.7 something million subscribers because remember we talked about platforms. So in the beginning, I had no platform, but I realized that the live stage performance was a type of platform, and I just needed to use that to capture emails. Mm-hmm. So you capture a bunch of emails, and let's say I get up to 30 or 35,000 emails totally by hand. Every single one of those emails was somebody who saw me at the show. The next step is, how do I get people to believe that I could be a legitimate host of a thing? So I was like, well, what do I got? I got a full tour schedule. I've got a stagehand that is now on the road with me who's pretty funny. And I've got these two super crappy, not even VGA level cameras. Like, yeah, they shot at 320 by 240.
And HD.
Like 8 kilohertz audio. It was awful. Wow. But we could take a t-shirt and wedge it in the corner of the cars, and we could, during the 3-hour drive, argue about bacon and try eating beef jerky and Chex Mix together and describe how it tastes, or just literally anything. And during that year, we made about 20 of these little vignettes. I was very, very bad at the beginning, but I had just enough of a platform. I got two things. First of all, I got to add to my sign off on every email, Brian Brushwood, bizarre magician and host of Brian Brushwood on the road. And whether you clicked on it or not, you now saw that word every single time. You couldn't unsee that word of host of blank. Second thing I got was learning that talking on camera is a very different thing than speaking extemporaneously like we're doing now. You speak in discrete bits so that future you or the editor can chop them up and make everything sound better. In fact, as we describe it on Scam School, I say, because oftentimes we're pulling people out of the bar, I say, hey, listen, starting right now, all of us have the power of time travel. If you are mid-sentence and you flub a word and you wish you could do it again, you don't have to apologize. You don't have to explain. Mm-hmm. Just stop talking, back up, and then do it again and get it cleaned. And that's all we have to do. And it's astonishing how fast just regular people off the street instantly pick it up. So at this point, I've learned the skill of how to talk to a camera because I've also played editor and all that stuff. But more importantly, I have a thing that I can point to as a resume. So when I had the idea for Scam School, one of the most popular things everybody would always do is as soon as the show was over, the students would want to go out, take me out to dinner, and they all wanted to learn a trick. And I realized, oh, wait, there's something universal here. There's an unmet need. There's an open niche for learning a bit of magic, some bar scans, to be the center of attention. And I realized, out of all the marketing books I've read, I think my favorite, it might not be the best, but my favorite metaphor comes from Alan Laura Reese's book, Origin of Brands, in which they speculate that just as there's a tree of life in Darwin's Origin of the Species, there is a tree of brands. You know, just like in the tree of life, there's the lizard branch, the bug branch, the fungus branch or whatever. You know, we have restaurant branches and banking branches and SUV branches. And also there are sub branches. And you'll notice that in the tree of life metaphor, everything constantly diverges. And if something diverges into a niche that is no longer necessary or is inappropriate, then it just withers and dies. That's why we don't have the El Camino anymore, but we do have the Ford Taurus. You think in terms of the Model T didn't morph over time to become the Ford Taurus, but instead you had a bunch of failed experience, just like, you know, a monkey didn't morph over time into being a human. So through that lens, through constant divergence, and a few of the rules that they bring up in the book, some of the people have listened to the 22 Immutable Laws of Marketing. They talk about this as well. It turns out the same rules that govern organic dominance also govern brand dominance. Number one, be first. If you're the first seed planted, you're going to get all the sunlight and you're going to be number one. If you're the second seed planted in the shade of the first tree, you're not going to get as much sunlight. You're not going to be able to go anywhere. And so if you can't be first in a category. And the example they give, you guys have probably heard this, but we all know who flew across the Atlantic the first time. Nobody knows the guy who was second, but we do know the third person, Amelia Earhart, because she was first in a category.
Yep.
And then likewise, as I think about it in the magic world, if you can't be David Copperfield, then you got to be Penn and Teller. If you can't be Coke, you could be Pepsi, which is the middle finger, the screw you dad to whatever the dominant thing is. And so with that in mind, I looked at the landscape and I realized, okay, niche is already filled for the number one broadcast magician. That was still David Copperfield or David Blaine at the top of their game, right?
Yep.
Niche was now filled for cable television magician. You know, everybody knew was watching Chris Angel go around doing Mind Freak. But then I realized, like, if I walked up to anybody, I say, who's that magician that you see on the internet all the time? They'd be like, I don't know.
Yep.
And then, so like that smelled like an open niche to me, right?
Yeah.
So then we just needed to figure a type of show that would fill that niche and that unmet hunger. And I realized that all of the numbers, this is very, very early days of YouTube, 2005. If you typed in bar tricks, you got hundreds of thousands of results. And the videos had millions of views, despite the fact that the production capability was abject garbage and that the hosts wouldn't even appear. They were just a pair of hands, or sometimes they weren't even comfortable talking. They would just put overlay text explaining what was happening. And I was like, okay, what if what if we captured the social proof of getting real people from the bar? What if we brought television level, high def capability production to all this? What if we proved to everybody, not just said, oh, and you'll be the hit of the bar, but like to see the amazement on other people's faces? Nobody's doing that. And I realized that was an unoccupied niche. So I pitched Scam School to a company called Revision 3. And originally they were all tech programming. So I had to figure out a tech angle for it. And so I said, hey man, every hacker knows that social engineering is a super important tool. It's not just the gizmos, it's also the people. So this is a whole show about social engineering at the bar and on the street. It's called Scam School. And it'll be hosted by me. And the reason you know I'm good is because look at this footage that I definitely just cut, edited, spent the last year learning how to do on
yeah,
the road.
Yeah.
And even though nobody really watched them, I would put them out to my email list of 30,000 people, of which I am now convinced only 10,000 were real. but it would get enough people to where they didn't have zero views. They had some kind of following and people were excited about it. But that was enough for Revision 3 to say, yeah, let's shoot some pilots. Let's see where it goes. And then now we're back to me borrowing somebody else's platform because they had their fans who were following everything. And here I was showing up, providing value, new content, something that they weren't doing anywhere else. And as a result, trying to capture that bandwidth. And so basically, my strategy for the next 10 years was always to show up on another platform, provide value to that platform, have a place to diversify. Once you get those eyeballs, get that interest, get that, hey, I kind of like that guy. Because even as Scam School did better and better on YouTube, I got scared because I realized, oh, wait, YouTube could shut down this channel at any time. They could decide scams and cons, we're family friendly here, and just shut it and I'd be totally hosed. So I realized I have to diversify my presence. So I was constantly saying, hey, if you have a question about blank or if you want to submit a blank, hit me up over at twitter.com/wood. So every single week it became this way to diversify. And then, you know, Twitter got big enough and I realized, oh, wait, at some point I might accidentally say something that'll get me kicked off Twitter, or maybe somebody will hack my account or whatever. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Also, by the way, the way I got verified on Twitter was that on one of our comedy podcasts, I just said, okay, listen, I'm going to deny we're doing this, but I'm telling all of you right now, every single one of you, I need you to make fake Brian Brushwood accounts. Say literally whatever you want. Steal some art on there, but just all of them variations. So somebody did Schwood, just SHW00D, or somebody misspelled Brian Bushwood, all of them with my face on there. It's like, you guys do that, and then I can loudly and repeatedly complain about all these fake
that
accounts.
Genius.
Yes.
And then finally, at some point, somebody's like, hey man, what's going on? What's with all these fake accounts? I was like, oh man, boy, I'll tell you. And then they're like, let me get you verified.
That's yes. Amazing. I love that.
All right. So if you want to get verified on Twitter, that's how you do it.
Right. But even then, I guess my point is once that happened, I realized, oh wait, even this could be taken away from me. So then that's when we started doing weekly giveaways to build up the email list.
Mm-hmm.
And now we feel pretty fairly diversified. I would say a lot of things would have to happen to totally shut me up at this point.
Yeah.
Between email, Twitter, 3 different YouTube channels and other opportunities.
Yeah. So I want to dive into The Modern Rogue a little bit. This is one of your YouTube channels and you just got a place in Austin to
yeah,
no, to we, do all the crazy stuff that you're doing?
You could say it. We built a cult compound.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
No,
cool.
It's a real thing.
Yeah.
No, we got, in fact, just down the road from where we are. It's,
yeah.
It's 7 acres and like everything around it is developed, but it's this valley in the hill country that I think if we can get above the tree line, we'll have a gorgeous view.
Mm-hmm.
But this place used to be a nudist colony. I bought it from an acupuncturist who got it from a Qigong master. I don't know if you know what Qigong is. Qigong is like the force.
Yeah.
It's martial arts is essentially magic, basically.
Yeah.
This place has like all of these old structures, none of which I know what they did or what they were for. But I know that this may have been a pool at some point, but now it's a fighting pit. I know that they had a bus on the property that used to be a train that got converted into a bus. And then when the engine went out, they put the engine they had laying around, which was a race car engine. So it's a train that's a bus with a race car engine.
That's wild.
There's so much insane stuff in there. And it's very much a fixer-upper. This is going to be like a 5-year process.
Chip and Joanna, get on it.
Yeah, seriously.
But the idea is, let's build a place that these people who have been following for the last 10 years, these people who are contributing through Patreon.com and so on, that they know, hey, someday I'm going to be here for South by Southwest. I could come out and visit and see the place. And
yeah.
In fact, I'm loving rolling with all the cult imagery, by the way, because because I think we're going to do our official opening on, I forget if it's April 8th or 9th, but that'll be our official opening party.
Yeah.
And then we'll do our 1-year anniversary, then our 2-year anniversary, then our 3-year anniversary. And on our 5th anniversary, if we open on April 8th or 9th, that will be when the total eclipse passes right over the property.
Oh,
that's
so
awesome.
Nice.
We can be there for the Great Ascension or whatever it is we want to call this
that's
thing.
That's amazing.
I won't be drinking the Kool-Aid.
So, but YouTube is a different beast than it once was. What's it like developing and growing a channel now versus years ago when you first started?
It's the same thing. You identify a niche that is hopefully totally unoccupied, or if it is occupied, it's occupied in a way that you feel like you can offer something nobody else has done. For example, teaching magic on YouTube niche was occupied when I showed up, but it was always occupied with just hands on the screen. Nobody was doing what I was doing. And so likewise, the niche of whiskey reviews was occupied when our friends over at the Whiskey Vault, Rex and Daniel, showed up, but they realized, oh wait, nobody is telling a long form, insane meta narrative along with all of these reviews, and they're not community focused. So they built their cult and they're getting ready to have their big opening. So, I would say if you're at zero, nothing's changed. It's still the Oklahoma land rush. It's just that you need to put a little more effort into figuring out what is the unoccupied niche that you could do and what is a way that you could take your message and add, as Rex puts it, you know, Rex calls it niche, type, and spice. Niche is the unmet need in the universe, the thing the world needs but doesn't even know they need it yet, that you could provide. The type is the structure of your show. Is this a daily vlog? Is this an aspirational lifestyle thing? Is the star of the show you, or is the star of the show the information that you teach? For example, Grant Thompson, the King of Random, the star of the show is the quality of the builds he does for all of his projects. It's very pleasing to see stuff done very, very well. I don't have that gift. My co-host Jason doesn't have that gift. We are in the exact same niche. And so we are intentionally like, what if we were 40-year-old man babies who definitely don't know anything, screw everything up, but still try and tell jokes or make each other laugh while we do it? Now, all of a sudden, we're occupying the same niche, but we're playing Pepsi to his Coke. Mm-hmm. And it's done very, very well, because keep in mind, the Modern Rogue as a brand is only 2 years old. Mm. And in that time, we've gone from 0 to 750,000 subscribers. And it's doesn't look like it's slowing anytime soon. So I would say nothing's changed except for just more people have grabbed more real estate, and it's more important to be focused and targeted on what you intend to own.
Don't be the same as everyone else.
Oh, you can't. I mean, you can if you want nobody to care or to watch.
Exactly.
But it's like spice is everything that comes after the word but. It's like it's blank, blank, blank that serves this, blah, blah, blah. But then it's comma, but unexpected third gravitational body, you know, unexpected. It's like Mythbusters, comma, but nothing works and they don't know what they're doing. You know, like now all of a sudden it's something different than Mythbusters.
Yeah.
I like that. That's cool. So you seem pretty successful, but not everyone starts that way. And along the road, there's probably a lot of failure.
So much failure.
Please dive in. I want to hear all the juicy bad times.
I'm a big fan of failure. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like there's no lessons in success. Every time you're successful, you will never know if you were just lucky or if the time was just right or whatever. Who I feel bad for are people who have success after success after success, because I know if that were me, I would increasingly wonder, am I just lucky? Or what do you sell yourself? That perverse narrative of, I'm the golden one. Everything I do is great. And of course, that often comes crashing down or whatever. Whereas with failure, there is a lesson in every single failure. I stood on stage in Elkins, West Virginia, doing a show that was unfortunately mocking everything that the 900 people there had hoped to see. They hoped to see the classic mid-90s magicians with the purple sequins and the tigers and the boxes and the girls jumping out. Instead, they got me constantly mocking that image, eating fire, sticking nails in my eyes, cutting off my tongue, fake blood all over the place. The only part they clapped was during the Roper trick, where I was intentionally play acting as if I was the type of magician that they wanted to see.
Wow.
They hated it. The show ended and I heard a thud and I looked over and somebody had thrown an orange at my props and it had smashed and was melting on there. And I was like, they're throwing fruit at my stage. That's a real thing that people do.
It's real.
Where did they get this orange?
Yes, somebody brought an orange on the off chance that they might want to throw it at my stage. And so then begins the lonely 6-hour drive down to North Carolina that I had to take. And of course, you're in the mountains and this is pre-internet. We don't have iPads or whatever on us. So I had nothing but my thoughts, not even the radio to distract me, as I thought, why did that go so poorly? What might have been different? And you start running counterfactual, you know, possibilities. Mm-hmm. And I realized, well, part of it is they all expected one thing. Also, the tech was really bad. I was like, okay, so the tech was bad. That hurt all the timing on the bits. But more importantly, at no point did anybody prep them for what I was about to be when I went out on stage. And I realized, I started thinking again, because I love systems. I love figuring out what are the exploits? Where is the latent bandwidth that we could take advantage of it? And I realized the show doesn't start when I walk on stage. The show starts when they walk into the theater. Because you go to the movie theater and, you know, they got ads for popcorn or whatever garbage. I was like, what if we had that kind of pre-show going, but it was magic trivia? What if it was a bunch of subversive magic jokes, something that were slightly, you know, PG-13 naughty? And then, oh, by the way, here's a picture of Brian standing next to Jay Leno, giving the trappings of authority. So by the end of that 30-minute pre-show, they would think, well, I still don't know who this guy is, but I know he has a ridiculous haircut. I know he has the trappings of success and probably merits, you know, me giving him the benefit of the doubt. And it's very clear to me that this guy, he's doing a magic show for people who don't normally like magic shows. So at the very least, they're primed at that point when I walk out. And then my first bit is always very, very, very humble. It's basically a history of fire eating. And there's never a moment that anybody needs to clap. And it's kind of weird in the beginning because I'm doing it because people are like, well, do we clap or not? And then there's this brief moment where I'm like, oh, and when this guy would do it, his audience would go nuts. And they're like, oh, now we know what to do, right? And so I realized that the show begins before the show begins. As you go through, your entire job is to win everybody over. Doesn't matter anything that comes before, as long as you end with everybody 100% on your side, you get that insane applause and standing ovation or whatever. But then second thing I realized, show doesn't end when the show's over. Mm-hmm. Now begins the other show of standing in line, meeting people, exchanging stories, signing stuff or whatever, hopefully getting their emails, hopefully keeping up the stories. And as a result, here we are. 2 decades later, there are people who got on my email list at shows in 2001 who have followed my career all the way to this and are now among my most passionate, you think of them as lieutenants or brand ambassadors, your street team or whatever. But if you want more failure stories.
I would just like to point out that was a single failure and like there's so much you extrapolated from that. That was a really long drive.
Yeah. Well, and plus also that fear of ever going through that again shapes you, right?
It
makes you realize, oh, no. I would rather work for 4 weeks reshooting this video, setting this all up. I ended up building a tech system out of old spare parts from a keyless remote entry systems for cars so that I could handle all my sound cues by clicking my feet together on stage because I realized, like, I can't trust the sound man. There's not enough time for us to rehearse and for him to get all the sound cues right. But once I took over that responsibility, doing it live from stage, I realized, oh man, I can have like 4 times the music and video cues. So that was a wonderful discovery, all of which came from a very, very painful experience. The early days, I would say my obsession with failure started when I was street performing on 6th Street 22 years ago. I realized that everybody I respected in magic had done a lot of magic and a lot of gigs. And I love street performing because nobody could tell you no. You didn't have to book the gig. You just had to show up and go. The worst thing that could happen is somebody would walk by and be bored by whatever it is you're doing. The best thing is, you know, you make beer money, $50 by the end of the day. It's so great because nobody owes you nothing. And everything you have, you've earned. You've earned the fact that they stopped. You've earned the fact that they're continuing to watch. You've earned that after 15 minutes, they feel like you've provided so much entertainment value that they get to decide what they would pay for this ticket price in that moment. To me, street performing was the most artistically pure thing I ever did. You go to Vegas, you know, you see the posters, you know, when you go see Donnie and Marie, there's all this history and baggage and there's an expectation of what you're going to get and what you're going to experience. You have none of that. You have to earn all of that on the street. Mm. And there was tons of times that have just failed. I've just mid routine, somebody would just be like bored now and then walk away.
Oh man.
I failed at a dance reality competition show, basically Dancing with the Stars for YouTubers. It was horrific and I was bad and I lost. And I did America's Got Talent. And then they misunderstood the trick. They thought I had actually injured myself. And so they all buzzed me off and I heard 2,000 people booing for me. And I realized at that point, my goal was like, okay, how do I make this footage unusable? By the way, traditionally in reality television, the moment one of the key players wants to make something unusable, they just constantly start dropping nothing but curse words.
Yeah.
So you physically can't use it.
Yeah.
Whereas what I did was I just went on a very long, boring lecture where I never let anybody get a word in edgewise because all they're looking for are those tight sound bites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they never got one. And so as a result, I think I showed up for like 3 seconds in a promo and that's it. So
wow,
bullet dodged on that one. But again, that's a lesson that was born of failure.
Yeah. So interesting question here. Marketing and magic share a lot of the same qualities. Is there any advice that you'd give to marketers given what you know about the power of magic and its effects on people?
Yeah. I would say marketing and magic are structurally identical in that you have something special at the end. In magic, it is the surprise. Teller says that the heart of all great magic, the compositional secret to all great magic, is surprise me. Put two and two in front of me, convince me it's 5, then reveal the truth 4 and blow me away. Which I like the fact that what you do is you tell the truth just in such a way that it leads people to an erroneous conclusion. And the delight that you experience is when you see, oh, no, wait, he was there the entire time. Mm-hmm. Or that was my card or whatever. Mm-hmm. In magic, you accomplish that by telling an adjacent but true story, or mostly true, or whatever. Maybe it's a made-up story. Yeah. It doesn't matter. But you withhold information, and you let people fill in the gaps. And then when they get to that surprise delight moment, hopefully they're like, that was the best thing ever. And hopefully, if you have a product that will surprise and delight, like there are things I've bought that I am just deeply, deeply in love with, and I'm so very, very thankful that they came across my radar. I don't know or remember what marketing tricks they used to get there. But mm-hmm. I know that at the end of it was surprise and delight. And I'm certain that they told a story that was adjacent or mostly true, but not really about it. Because we were talking about these noise-canceling headphones. I know for sure what they didn't tell me is, these were built in this factory and this are the gizmos and this is what it is. Mm. They told me some other story about how much it means to have a quiet moment of solace while you're in an airport or whatever. That is an adjacent story to the fact of this little chunk of electronics. And it's true enough, but I did not buy it for the electronics. I bought it for that blissful moment of Zen. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, you want to do the same thing in magic. Just like these gizmos, electronics don't matter. It doesn't matter if the card was the 7 of hearts or whatever. But if I tell you the story of how my grandfather taught me this trick and every time it happens, it doesn't always work. But when it does work, I feel in my heart like my grandfather is here with me. We've done this. We did that. Everything seems fair. I sure hope we are about to experience some magic. And you turn over that card and it's the 7 of hearts because you've changed the context, because you've laid out a better narrative over it. All of a sudden, you know, somebody gasping and crying in the back thinking of their grandfather or whatever. Marketers do the same thing. And again, these are all tools. They could be used for good or they could be used for evil.
Evil.
Yeah. We were just talking about the power of the offer, and you can have the same product and it's just all about how you contextualize that offer and package it in different ways.
Yeah. Well, even just thinking about, you know, the surprise and delight part, if the story is not a good story or it doesn't tell people what it's going to be, how they'll be surprised or delighted, then it doesn't work. You know, if you tell a story that's totally like off the radar of what they're expecting and it's not a delightful surprise, then you've totally like broken trust.
Yeah. So that's a really good point, because notice that phrase, a delightful surprise. You could surprise anyone. I could just start immediately screaming right now and it would be a surprise to everyone. However, I don't think you would be delighted.
Yeah.
Delightful is, and again, you know, I think of it in terms of niche type and spice. Delightful is listening to your niche. Like, what is unmet that we could fulfill for them? For example, we've got a ring on Scam Stuff that inside of it is a micro escape tool that's got a serrated edge. You can use it to saw your way out of zip ties, or you can use it to shim a police issued handcuff. In and of itself, if you just had it there, then that's the end of the story. It's like, this is a ring that'll let you get out of those things. It's like, well, I don't expect to be kidnapped or arrested anytime soon. Yeah. Also, that would be illegal to be arrested, right? But instead, what we did is we took it and we etched 23 symbols around it, each one being crib notes to a different scam school trick that we've had in the past. We added story to it. So, and then we put people in a very specific situation. This is me listening to Niche, because I know I've been in that place where somebody in the room says, oh, Brian knows some magic. What do you do? And then I'm the host of freaking Scam School. We've done 700 episodes. And there are times I think like, I don't know. What do I know? Oh, geez. And so the thinking is, on your ring, you just look and you run through. You're like, oh, no, that's a good one. Oh, yeah, no, I can do that one. And these are all the setups to, you know, you may not remember exactly the exact number of matches you need for X, Y, or Z, but it's all on the ring, right? So now there's a story to it. And then also, yes, it's very unlikely you're going to be kidnapped and you're going to need this thing to get out. But there are two situations that will happen. Number one, you will experience a quiet confidence that you would not have experienced before without this ring. And more importantly, you get to show this thing off at every party. Let's say you don't even get to a point of doing any magic. You get to take off this ring and say, hey, by the way, this ring lets you escape from handcuffs. Let me show you. And then all of a sudden, now you're the most interesting person in the room again. Mm-hmm. So again, we're aspiring to tell stories bigger than the gizmos that we're selling.
So knowing what you know now about entrepreneurship, business, everything that you've been a part of, what advice would you give to your 25-year-old self?
25-year-old self.
25.
You know, I think I did pretty good at this advice, but it's the advice I give everyone. My universal advice is don't wait. There's a million really good reasons why you should wait, and you should ignore all of them. In the world of magic, I would tell people, yes, you should wait until you get a better headshot. Yes, you should wait until you buy that big magic prop and stop using the one you made out of cardboard. Yes, you should wait until you get that script exactly right. Ignore all of that. Go out there, be bad, because here's the thing. You must be bad to be good. So find a safe space to be bad so you can become good. For me, it was like the streets were a very safe place to be bad. Worst thing that could happen, nobody was going to write a review. Like, I was walking down the street last night and you know, it was very safe. And I was very bad for a very long time. But out of badness comes goodness. But
quote it.
Yeah, right. Likewise, I was a bad host at the beginning. And then you could see, you know, watching over Scam School, I got good. And then I realized, oh, wait, the guys who really know what they're doing, there are guys who could sit down on a mic like this and just talk for hours and hours and hours. Well, how do they do that? And I'm like, well, I don't know. Let's find out. So on January 1st, 2009, I flipped on a webcam. And this is back when Ustream and Justin.tv were just getting started. And I thought to myself, well, I don't want to send out an email to my email list because that'll be thousands of people watching me be bad. But I do have a couple hundred Twitter followers. That'll be a very small number of people watching me be bad. Mm-hmm. So I tweeted out, hey, I'm going to go live, call in, Skype, we'll talk magic or whatever. And it was very bad and very painful or whatever. But years and years, you get better at understanding how to keep everything afloat and to improvise. And especially as you work with comedy partners, you know, you just build and build and build from there.
Yeah. Wow. That's great advice.
Thank you for that. Yeah.
We have a similar kind of mantra here where it's just ship it. Just put it out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When it comes to podcasting, my advice is always the same. I say record 10 episodes and that 10th one will be your first. And if you want to justify the other 9 existing, call them bank shows. Say you're going to use it for some week when you're sick or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the truth is, when you go back, by the time you hit episode 20 and you go back and listen to those first 9, you'd be like, these are never going to see the light of day.
We were really like tiny baby deer.
Yeah. We did that same exact thing. We recorded a few episodes when we first started. And once we started getting into the swing of things and started really figuring out what worked and what didn't, we listened to those old episodes and we were like, Oh my God.
Well, and that of course came from inside you, right?
Yeah.
Because nobody can tell you what to do. Because if you do, you could do your best to mimic it robotically and create a pale imitation of whatever it is you're trying to be. But I believe that if you want to figure out what you want to do, then figure out everything you hate. I think hate yields better, faster, easier results than aspirational love for something. Artistically, if you want to try to capture your love for your wife or whatever, the best thing you're going to do is a pale imitation of your love for your wife. But for me, when I was thinking of designing my magic show, it's like, well, what does that hate? I hate when magicians use cheesy, outdated 80s music. I hate when they dress this way. I hate the way they talk down to people. And those are some easy things that you can immediately sketch out. Now, all of a sudden, you're getting closer and closer to something that's uniquely you. In other words, if you just try to be something you love, you'll just be a bad copy of it. But if you be the opposite of everything you hate, you will be something uniquely you. And the only way to find out what you hate is to make those mistakes, is to live the Groundhog Day existence of doing podcast after podcast. And then, you know, maybe the two of you get into a fight mid-podcast. You're like, that was deeply unpleasant. Let's never do that again, which definitely happened on my podcast once.
Oh, wow.
Oh man.
And so figure out what you hate and you'll have an easier time discovering what's already in you that, that will resonate with the world.
Thank you so much, Brian, for being on the show.
Yeah, this was great.
A great conversation.
My mind's still, like, the gears are still spinning. I'm like, what can I apply this to? Everything.
But before we go, where can people find out more about you and what you're working on?
We finally updated my homepage.
Yes.
So my name is Brian Brushwood, and you could go to Brian Brushwood if you could figure out how to spell it. Or you could do just the last six letters, Schwood, S-H-W-O-O-D. There is no C in Schwood. I'm Schwood on Twitter. I answer every at reply. You can email me at brian@schwood.com where it might get seen and possibly replied to 3 months later as I say, whoa, can't believe I missed this 3 months ago. but yeah, everything's at schwood.com.
Awesome.
Awesome. Cool. Right. Thank you so much. Also, awesome name for like a Texan magician.
Right?
Brushwood. Brian Brushwood.
That's so great. I love it.
Awesome. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
We'll see you next time.
Whoa.
Ah.
Did he just disappear?
I'm sorry. That was so cheap.
I had to do it.
No, I really, you know, there's one thing that I regret from this conversation today. And that is that we didn't get Brian to do any magic for us.
I know. It's so funny. I was like, oh, maybe he'll do a trick. But no, he was just being a normal person. I didn't want to bother him about it.
But hey, the magic is in the lesson.
Totally.
That's what it's all about.
Totally. I did not know you were going to do that, Garrett.
Did I scare you?
Yeah.
Good.
I thought maybe there was a spider.
Whoa.
I really, really loved talking to Brian. It was really cool to see, you know, just kind of how he uses these back doors in, you know, the psychology of people. And it's effective for magicians. It's effective for marketers. It's effective for doctors. It's effective for teachers. Like, this is just how people work. And if you can figure that out and leverage it, you're going to be successful.
Yeah. This idea that magic is just how people perceive something that's happening. I mean, we see a lot of that in marketing as well, not from the perspective of, oh, in marketing, you're, you know, scamming people into something, but, you know, with magic, you're framing an idea, you're framing a concept in a way that your audience believes what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And in marketing, we kind of do those same things, you know, in a little bit less of a showstopper type of way, but in a way that, you know, we can connect with our audience and frame different concepts in their minds. You know, I really love how Brian built up his audience. I think the big takeaway for me today is just how he started from not a lot and kind of failed his way up the ladder, if you will, but did some really smart things along the way through, you know, again, collecting emails on stage at comedy shows and using that audience in a way to hack the system a little bit.
I just love the concept of feeling safe being bad. A lot of us have trouble putting something out into the world that's not perfect, which means you'll never put anything out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert on that one. But I just really love, you know, that concept. Like, he knew he was going to be bad and he knew he had to test stuff out. And so he just took to the streets and allowed himself to fail and allowed himself to learn and grow.
Building an audience is so important. And one of the ways, you know, in the modern world to really build your audience effectively is through social media. And you've heard us talk on here before about the importance of social media, but not only the importance of social media, but the importance of effectively tracking your social media. How do you know if you're effectively doing what you need to do on social media to grow that audience?
Yeah.
So that's really why we developed, you know, what we call the social media scorecards here at Digital Marketer, where we talk about the important things to look at in your social media strategy to
really track the success of how well you're building your audience, how well you're engaging with your audience, and how well you're building up that loyalty factor and not just focusing on the vanity metrics. So if you want to pick up these social media scorecards, just head on over to digitalmarketer.com/scorecards. They're completely free, and it's a resource that we created here at DM to help you grow your audience and track what's important. So if you're interested in growing your audience through social media and tracking that effectively, I would highly recommend going over to digitalmarketer.com/scorecards and pick up a copy of the social media scorecards for you and your business today. Thanks for joining
us
today.
Thanks for listening, y'all.
We hope that these concepts and strategies that we talked with Brian don't just disappear out of thin air, if you will. No, okay. All jokes aside, big thanks to Brian for joining us today. It was a great conversation, and we hope you got as much out of it as we did. We'll see you same time, same place next week.
See you then. Bye.
Hey, DM listeners, if you're running a Black Friday or Cyber Monday special, listen up, because Digital Marketer just released our Canva Holiday Promo Pack. It includes almost 200 templates that you can use to make the graphics for all your upcoming holiday specials and 3 unique design themes for each holiday. The Promo Pack is usually $27, but you can get it today for free. Check the show notes for the link to download, or you can go directly to digitalmarketer.com/LP/holiday templates. That's digitalmarketer.com/LP/holiday templates.